Please silence all electronic devices.
I'm sorry, folks. I don't trust them, and our folks don't trust them.
There is a great deal of overreaction from those who are criticizing this legislation. They will see me in court. You know, if the General Assembly were really trying to do a power grab, there's a lot of things the General Assembly could do, and we weren't.
And they don't have a very good track record there.
Any further discussion or debate?
From the American Tobacco Historic District in downtown Durham, this is the WUNC Politics Podcast. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Solid choice out of you downloading this program. Plenty, as usual, playing out in North Carolina politics. However, our focus today will be out of state, with the North Carolina General Assembly convening 2 weeks from now. Seemed like a decent enough time to have a couple of conversations with State House reporters from elsewhere in the country. So today, what's happening legislatively in the Keystone State and the Centennial State? That's Pennsylvania in a bit. First, Colorado. Bente Birkeland is a public affairs reporter with Colorado Public Radio. She has covered the happenings in Denver for more than a decade now. And as she begins her political coverage here in 2019, there's a little bit more blue in the state legislature where she works.
For the first time in 4 years, Democrats hold a majority in both the state House, the state Senate, and we have a governor who just won elections. So they're definitely in charge of everything. And so we'll see what they come up with. We're still at the beginning of our legislative session, the formal budget's being presented, and the work is really getting underway because the first few days are a lot of ceremonial events.
New governor in Colorado, Jared Polis, a Democrat, I believe the first openly gay governor of any state in the country. Was that a significant factor? Has that been very important as he has been sworn in, that element of who he is? Or is that more or less kind of a secondary storyline here?
You know, it's pretty interesting. During the campaign, it was more of a secondary storyline. It really wasn't much of a storyline. Polis is someone who's extremely wealthy. He was a member of Congress for a decade. He's from Boulder. There were campaign ads featuring him and his partner and their two children. But beyond that, it wasn't an issue he really talked about. And his Republican opponent didn't mention it either. During his inauguration, though, Polis did bring it up, and a lot of the people I talked to from the public who were there to watch his swearing-in ceremony, for them it was a really big deal that it was happening. But I don't think it's necessarily going to continue to be an issue throughout the session.
So Democrats now have control of both chambers of the legislature. This is something that we in North Carolina saw kind of the different end of the table in 2010. Republicans won control for the first time in 140 years. And they moved to the right. They added supermajorities in 2012 in the elections down here, as our listeners will remember. For you all, in what is, you know, a competitive state nationally, to me, always a very interesting state, what does it mean for Democrats to have this triumvirate right now?
You know, I think a lot of people were elected on pretty progressive ideas, and we have more women serving in the legislature than we've ever had. We're one of only two states, Colorado and Nevada, that have a legislative chamber with a majority of women. And so that will change the dynamic a little bit. For the third time in a row, we've elected a female Speaker of the House. But the last time Democrats were in charge of everything, it was extremely controversial. It was right after the Newtown shooting in Connecticut and the Aurora Theater shooting here in Colorado. Democrats passed stricter gun laws and limited high-capacity magazines. This was in 2013. It led to the first successful recalls in state history. The Democratic Senate president was recalled from office. So was another Democratic senator. A third one resigned versus facing a recall. And then Republicans captured the state Senate in the next election. So Republicans here are feeling like Democrats are going to overreach and, you know, it'll be problematic. But a lot of Democrats feel the opposite and say, hey, we have this mandate. There's a lot of pent-up things we've wanted to get done, and we're going to get those things done.
Interesting. You and I spoke briefly before we hit record here, and one of the things you did mention was this effort, at least, and I want to hear more about it, by some on the left, some within the Democratic Party, to move to a place of being 100% renewable energy in 21 years, by 2040. How are they going to do that? And is this a lofty goal, or is this attainable from your perspective?
I think it's hard to say. I mean, it's probably a little bit of both. It's something our Governor Jared Polis made one of his top campaign priorities. So we haven't really seen any legislation on that yet. I think we will pretty soon. There's also a kind of a companion issue related to oil and gas development in the state. We're one of the top producing states for that and for fracking, and there's been a lot of controversy. There was a ballot initiative that failed that would have widened the setback distances between drilling rigs and homes and schools. Democrats say they want to introduce legislation on that, and the governor feels like communities should have more of a say on where development takes place. So I think that will certainly be a big fight this session. The governor is putting a lot of money, hoping to, in the state's first ever water plan to try to improve conditions when there's drought. So I think that's a little bit to be determined in terms of the policies we may see on the renewable energy. But it's a focus of a lot of Democrats, not just the governor.
This may be a dumb follow-up, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Square for me how you can be 100% renewable and still have so much drilling for oil going on in the state. I mean, they're not proposing shutting that down completely, or are they? Or would that just be exported out of Colorado?
I honestly don't know, and I think that's a big fear that the energy industry is concerned about, wondering what that would mean for them. It brings in a lot of money to the state, tax revenue that's used to pay for a lot of things, and also pretty high-paying jobs that people don't want to lose.
Okay. A number of things I want to, I guess, just touch on briefly with you, because I think it's interesting, if not instructive, to see what's happening in other states, whether they're deeply red or deeply blue or similar to North Carolina. Hues of and shades of purple are often in effect. Paid family leave. I guess just give us the basic parameters of what you're expecting to see on paid family leave in the legislature this year.
We're expecting a big package on that. Democrats haven't unveiled it yet. So far, what we have is a budget request from the governor for about $2-3 million to create 8 weeks of paid parental leave for all state employees. But Democrats want to go well beyond that into the private sector. And I think there's a lot of negotiations happening right now with the business community to see if they can get to a place where they do have some support from the business community. They've proposed bills before that have failed. That's when we had a split legislative chamber and Republicans defeated those measures. So that'll come a little bit later in our session. Our session goes from January to mid-May.
Let's talk education briefly. A free full day of kindergarten. That is already provided here in North Carolina, but it's not in Colorado, I gather. What would entail to get this passed? And if you know, what would the price tag be?
Well, the price tag is about $230 million, and the governor is proposing to take it out of a budget surplus we're seeing from higher than expected property tax values. And so right now, Colorado funds half-day kindergarten. Most of the students in the state do have full-day kindergarten. School districts either take money from other programs to fund it, or in some cases, parents pay tuition. That can sometimes be up to $500 a month. And so Polis is saying, look, it should be free for everyone. I don't know whether Democrats are going to be on board with that. And he obviously needs Democrats to be on board since they're in charge of both chambers. There's concerns about other budget priorities like transportation. Some people have talked about phasing it in. Others want it to give it to school districts to use the money however they want. During the recession, the state redirected about $1 billion to schools, so they're still trying to backfill some of that money. I think it'll be one of the more interesting policy discussions of the session because the governor has said it is his top legislative priority.
Interesting. And it doesn't sound like there's necessarily opposition to free full-day kindergarten, but that there might be other educational priorities or the desire to give districts more flexibility. Am I hearing you right on that?
I think that's definitely right, and also just other budget priorities.
Transitioning a little bit, one thing that the Colorado legislature will not be taking up this year is independent redistricting. That's because they already approved a ballot question, and then the voters approved it, if I'm remembering correctly, back in November, to create an independent redistricting commission. So I guess lay out for us what will happen either in 2019 or 2020. How is independent redistricting possibly going to work in your state?
Yeah, we'll see. Colorado voters approved these two ballot measures to create a commission. And like you said, it's made up of four Democrats, four Republicans, and four unaffiliated voters. And the commission will be required to maximize the number of politically competitive districts. So this will be especially interesting because Colorado is expected to pick up a new congressional seat in 2020 after the census. Prior to this initiative passing, the state legislature drew congressional districts and then a commission drew statehouse districts. And it typically ended up with a judge making the final decision, sometimes a competing set of maps. So the state is really hoping to avoid that this time around. I think there'll be a lot of focus on who serves on this commission. We have a lot of unaffiliated voters in the state. I think they actually make the largest percentage of voters now, or really close. They turned out in droves this last election, but just because someone's unaffiliated doesn't mean they don't have strong policy positions. They just may not want to affiliate with either party. So people will be watching this closely.
Of course. And who has appointment power to the redistricting commission?
I should clarify, there'll be two separate commissions, but there will be a lottery system, and that will be used alongside a panel of retired judges to pick commission members.
And is it safe to expect that there will be litigation, there will be some sort of legal challenge by someone who doesn't feel thrilled with how this is playing out?
I think it's hard to say. I know that opponents feel like this selection process would make people less accountable to voters because they're not elected officials and that it maybe is too random. And so some of the people won't have the necessary experience and knowledge to be on these commissions. So I think people I talked to who did not vote for these ballot measures didn't feel like this would be the solution. They thought it sounded nice, but it wouldn't solve any problems. So I think we'll just have to wait and see.
There's another proposal. You'll have to tell us if it's been filed or not, but there has been chatter in your state about moving the electoral college votes for presidential candidates to the popular vote. Tell us about why this has come up and where things stand.
Yes, Democratic lawmakers have introduced the legislation. If it passes, Colorado's electoral votes would be awarded to the winner of the national popular vote, even if that person didn't win Colorado. But the catch is the policy is only going to go into effect if the law passes in enough states to cover the majority of electoral votes. So, you know, it wouldn't go into effect yet. I think it's worth noting that most of the other places that have passed this have been more reliably blue in presidential years. Even though Colorado's trending that way, this could be one of the most competitive states to approve this idea. It has been debated in Colorado before, and it's failed multiple times. Some people just really feel like it'll diminish the voices of people living in smaller sized states, and Colorado has about 5.5 million people.
Finally, just looking back at about a year ago, you did a series of stories exposing a pattern of sexual harassment, inappropriate sexual behavior among lawmakers and staff. You ran dozens of stories. I believe you said there were something like 15 different allegations that emerged due to your reporting. Where do things stand now, and what significant changes have played out at your Capitol because of the work you did?
Yeah, well, we're still somewhat in the middle of it, but it's not as intense as last session. We had two expulsion votes. One lawmaker was expelled, the second expulsion in the state, and the first in more than 100 years. Others have either been ousted or resigned or decided to not seek re-election or trying to find other jobs to leave early. And the state did probably the largest study of any place in the country, an analysis on the workplace culture. It was an independent consultant and several hundred page report talking about the different various problems. And so lawmakers created an interim committee to study the issue. And then this session, they'll be crafting changes to the workplace harassment policy. There is a policy, but no one had ever really used it before. And so as we were reporting on it, people saw various flaws in the current system. For instance, when you file a complaint against a sitting lawmaker, the person in charge of any type of punishment is the leader of that chamber. So a lot of people don't want to file a complaint if the leader of the chamber is going to know they're the ones filing it, and then also not necessarily trusting what the consequence will be. So I think lawmakers, Republicans and Democrats, want to set up a committee of lawmakers that would recommend consequences. They'll have to decide things on open records. Right now, nothing's an open record. I was only able to report on complaints that were filed and get those documents because sources gave me that information. But there's a proposal to see if lawmakers are investigated by outside investigators and it's found credible, some information should be made public because voters are the ones that ultimately can decide. So if someone has 10 allegations, that should be something members of the media or the public should be able to uncover. So, you know, they haven't reached agreement on all of that stuff, but just the reporting process and anonymity and different ways to report. And then one thing that Colorado's looking at that other states, I don't know if they have it, but it's an informal complaint process and as well as formal, because some behavior may not be as egregious that someone wants to file a formal complaint. They may want the behavior to stop, but they don't want to have to go through that whole process. So Colorado is considering a way to, you know, have a middle person bring a lawmaker in or a lobbyist or whoever and say this behavior needs to stop before it escalates to something more formal as a way to try to tamp down on things. So that'll be coming later in this session, but you know, I think we'll have an interesting policy discussion on it.
Benta Berkland is a public affairs reporter with Colorado Public Radio on Twitter at BENTEBIRKELAND. Benta, thanks for coming on the podcast.
My pleasure.
Ahead, from Denver, we'll head east to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania for a conversation about partisan gerrymandering and also a big energy topic that's expected to play out in the coming months. I'm Jeff Tiberi. This is the WUNC Politics Podcast.
When you need a break, check out WUNC Music. It's North Carolina Public Radio's music discovery radio stream.
No, don't you worry, we'll all float on, all right.
It's an endless stream of hand-picked, locally sourced great songs.
And it won't be long till we're traveling on.
Listen and learn more about it at WUNCmusic.org.
Welcome back to the WUNC Politics Podcast. I'm Jeff Tiberi. We turn our attention now to Harrisburg, capital city of Pennsylvania, for a chat with Charles Thompson. He's a government and public policy reporter for the Patriot News. Charles, appreciate you making some time for us.
Glad to be here, Jeff.
In your state, similar to North Carolina, Republicans hold majorities of both chambers, while a Democrat has the governorship. Tom Wolf was sworn into office for a second term this week. You covered the event, you wrote about it, and then I'm going to read your own tweet back to you. You tweeted out, "If inaugurals are all about making us feel better about ourselves, then Governor Tom Wolf hit the right notes. Of course, inaugurals don't make fights and issues go away, but it's a nice pause to celebrate democracy." I like that tweet, so that's part of the reason I'm going to pick on you a little bit. But if you would, unwrap that tweet a little bit for me.
Basically, you know, the context was that Governor Wolf had a first term that where he went through a real learning curve. He came out with some very dramatic and bold public policy initiatives, a lot of which, you know, revolved around dramatically reforming our tax structure in Pennsylvania. And of course, it was that dovetailed with a tax increase, and the Republican legislative leaders were having none of a broad-based tax increase when they didn't feel it was really needed. So Wolf was sort of, he sort of ran into a brick wall with all of his lofty policy ambitions. And in the latter half of his first term, he really started to deal more with what's possible, what's achievable, and where can I find common cause with these Republicans? So we got some modest legislation through on things like public pension reform and allowing a liberalization of beer and wine sales. So in Pennsylvania, like most states in the country now, you can buy beer in some grocery stores and wine in some grocery stores. We had all been in state stores up until this point. And new revenue came from expanded gambling, as opposed to broad-based tax increases like an increase in sales tax or the state's personal income tax. The reason being that, you know, that's a much more politically safe thing to do because people feel like it's a voluntary tax. If I go to a casino and you know, this state takes off 34% of the casino's profits. That's better than them taxing me directly. So, you know, we started reaching for lower hanging fruit in Pennsylvania, and I think Governor Wolf found that he likes success, and it seems like he's coming back for his second term with a General Assembly that continues in Republican hands. So it still seems like he has kind of set aside some of his bigger things and is just going to continue to work on incremental progress, and hope that if he gets four more years of incremental progress, that he'll be able to turn around and have and look at that as a pretty nice tenure as governor. Point being, Wolf has learned to get along with the Republican legislative leaders and vice versa, but that doesn't mean that they're going to agree on all issues.
Over under number of lawsuits they have against each other at this point, and I can't tell you the current tally of what it is here in North Carolina. It sounds like the working dynamic is a little bit better there than it has been between the governor here in North Carolina, Roy Cooper, and then the leaders of the legislature, Phil Berger and Tim Moore. Are there, I just briefly, it's a throwaway, but are there pending cases against one another, or have they not gone the lawsuit route?
Nothing major right now.
Okay.
I mean,
okay.
We had a big court fight in the early part of 2018 over, you know, what we were going to do about these new congressional maps.
Right.
And that found the legislature and the administration on the wrong side of each other. But,
that's where I'm going right now. So let me just jump in and ask you. Obviously, Pennsylvania was home to what was a story that caught the eyes of a lot of people around the country, not a racial gerrymandering challenge, but a partisan gerrymandering challenge. And this, as you right. just alluded to, played out in 2018. It was over the congressional districts, 18 U.S. House seats that Pennsylvania has. The state Supreme Court ruled that they were illegal from a partisan standpoint. The Republicans tried to take it to the U.S. Supreme Court, I believe twice, at least twice.
Right.
At one point, five state Supreme Court justices were threatened with impeachment. It was a redistricting circus, and I mean that just matter-of-factly, not even in a making-fun way. Remind us, what has been the ultimate impact thus far of the congressional seats that had to be redrawn because your state Supreme Court ruled that they were illegal partisan gerrymanders?
The court gave the legislature and the governor a very truncated opportunity to try to come up with new maps. They failed. They really didn't even try because, you know, the legislature's focus for a long time was on trying to get the state Supreme Court ruling overturned, and the governor didn't really seem to get things engaged as far as trying to bring people together to negotiate. So it finally fell to the court was saying if you guys don't craft a map as per your constitutional requirement here by such and such a date, we are going to assign this to Stanford professor Nathan Persily, and he actually did get the job, and he imposed a map. He drafted a map for the court, and the court imposed that map for our 2018 elections. And after the U.S. Supreme Court decided not to intervene, we actually managed to pull these elections off, primaries and general elections on the new lines. And I got to say, I mean, the method is not one that anybody would really want. I mean, you don't want courts imposing legislative lines, generally speaking. I'm sympathetic to the legislature that it's best to have elected representatives doing that, or if you have an independent commission, but not have it mandated by judges.
Nathan Persily, a name that probably resonates for some North Carolina politicos because the Stanford law professor drew legislative maps here in North Carolina 2 years ago now. I'm just looking at some notes here. It was in Guilford. These counties mean nothing to you, but for our listeners, Cumberland and Guilford, Mecklenburg, Wake, Hoke County, and I think Sampson County was in there as well. He drew maps at one point just during the ongoing redistricting saga that played out here. So let me ask you this, I guess, big picture. As the congressional maps were redrawn in Pennsylvania, there's certainly a more balanced partisan split now, 9-9. Who's most upset with where are the Republicans still upset? Have they kind of taken their medicine on this and they're good with it? Have the Democrats taken this with a light on independent redistricting? Or I mean, what's next in this effort, this fight?
The Republicans are upset. The court situation with the congressional districts has had the perverse effect, I think, of kind of taking some of the steam out of the redistricting reform effort in Pennsylvania, because a lot of the people that were starting to pay attention to that and get behind that, you know, now all of a sudden got what they want. They got competitive districts, districts that reflect, are more reflective of regions and the state as a whole. And it has kind of banked the fire for redistricting reform. The other aspect to that is that we now have divided government in Harrisburg. For this redistricting cycle, we will have a Democratic governor and a Republican legislature. So all parties will have a seat at the table in crafting the final map. And that,
and your governor does have veto power there, right? I wanted to, before yep. we, yeah, okay, because the governor here does not have veto power when it comes to legislative redistricting. So,
okay, well, yeah, now, yeah, there's a little bit of a distinction there. The congressional seats, Wolf is a player, and he has to sign off. We do that in the form of a bill that has to pass the legislature and have the governor's signature. Our legislative redistricting is a little different. We have a legislative redistricting commission that is made up of four, you know, Senate and House leaders from both parties, and then the fifth is a neutral appointee that they are supposed to agree to. If they can't agree to it, then the Supreme Court will appoint the fifth member of the Legislative Reapportionment Commission. And they make the maps, and they ultimately have the final say. And if anybody wants to challenge their map, then that would be done in court. So the governor is not so much a factor in the House and Senate, State House and Senate right. seats here.
Right. Understood. All right. Let's transition. I want to talk for a couple of minutes about energy. There are nuclear plants in your state that are up for relicensing. And I mean, as you and I chatted about earlier today, this is a big issue, potentially a major issue legislatively in 2019. The nuclear plants are not profitable, but they do make up, I read online today, it's like 42-43% of the state's electricity. It's a 16,000 employee industry, and there are some major implications here. Just set up for us, what's at stake in the coming weeks and months?
We have 9 reactors, commercial reactors at 5 plants, and two of the 5 plants, the operators have announced that they are prepared to close those plants rather than go through their next relicensing because the plants aren't profitable. And this has led to a effort by legislators and the energy companies to try to see if the state would be interested in doing a bailout for the nuclear plants, similar to what has been done, I believe, in Illinois and New York, and I think there are some other states that are considering it too. Their argument is what they've essentially proposed is one of 3 ways that the nuclear plants could get a little bit of a lift and become more self-sustaining, more self-sufficient, I guess, or more profitable. One of them would be the inclusion of nuclear energy into a list of alternative energy sources that power companies are required to use for a portion of their electricity sales. We have a law that requires that alternative energy portfolio to grow to 18% by 2021. And it typically has been a way to try to nurture wind and solar. Nuclear makes the argument that we don't put out any carbon emissions in nuclear power, so we should be entitled to the, we should be allowed to be in this carve out. And that's a captive market that the power companies have to use. And the theory being that it would boost nuclear sales. Another policy proposal is zero emissions credits that provide a direct subsidy to the nuclear plants for every megawatt hour of emissions-free electricity generated. And that's based on like what they call the avoided cost of carbon emissions. And then finally, they're talking about, could the Pennsylvania develop some kind of a carbon tax that would effectively impose higher costs on oil, gas, and coal? So this is one of the debates that looms large in our state in 2019, because the clock is ticking on a couple of these nuclear plants, one of them being the infamous or the notorious Three Mile Island plant that almost had a meltdown in 1979. Some of your listeners might remember. But there's hundreds of jobs at stake in the nuclear industry at those plants, and both with the direct employees and the contractors that work there. And so it's going to be an interesting fight. I don't think a lot of the Pennsylvania lawmakers know a lot about the subject, but it's one of those things where they're going to have to get an informal education on it really quick.
Charles Thompson, reporter for the Patriot News in Pennsylvania, covering the state capital of Harrisburg. Charles, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Yeah, I'm glad to add some Pennsylvania flavor.
You can follow what's happening in Harrisburg in the coming days, weeks, months ahead by following Charles Thompson at CHAS Thompson 1, CHASTHOMPSON1 on Twitter. For Charles Thompson, as well as Benta Berkland, I'm Jeff Tiberi. Thanks for tuning into this edition of the podcast. You know the deal. Download it anywhere that you get your on-demand listening, and also subscribe to the program at Google Play, iTunes, and Stitcher as well. Stay up to date on whatever happens next week in North Carolina politics at our website, wunc.org. Thanks for tuning in.